Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Susan King. We're at Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect. I am so excited about my guest today that I have been reading the book and reading the book and reading the book and reading the book since I bought it back in February. And every time I read it, I get something new out of it. My guest today is Dr. Jude Kuravan, and she is one of the co-authors of probably one of the most compelling books that I have seen in recent years, and it's called Cosmos, and it's the co-creator's guide to the whole world. And in reading this book, there are a lot of things that came to mind, but one of the things that is so important is that it links science and spirituality, and I think that, you know, for a lot of people, that bringing together those two modalities is going to be very, very important for the future. A little bit about Dr. Kuravan, and I'm going to call her Jude, and I guess y'all can too. And when we started this conversation, I said, "Hey, Jude," and that kind of rang some tones back to the 60s for me. But she is a cosmologist, a sensitive healer, Hay House author, futurist, and educator. She is living currently in Avebury, England, and she has been experienced in multidimensional realities and researched consciousness, perennial wisdom, and metaphysics since early childhood. She holds a PhD in archaeology, researching ancient cosmologies, and an Oxford University master's degree in physics, specializing in cosmology and quantum physics. You read this book, and I think that it's not her only work, actually, and we might jump into some of that, too. But being not a scientist by any stretch of the imagination, when we first delved into this book, which I had been told by one of my spiritual teachers, Colette Baron-Reed, who introduced a whole bunch of us to this book back in February, that when she got finished reading it, she had highlighted probably every word in the book. So having learned that from her, I highlighted nothing, so I'm still looking at white pages. But one of the things that I noticed about this book more than anything is how it relates holographically everything in our lives and how we are who we are, which is really where the genealogy comes in. I have pronounced this, I guess, every time I've done my radio show, is that from our ancestors, we can learn who we are by learning who they were. And we can also learn why we are who we are because of how they lived their lives. So, Jude, I want to bring you in. How are you doing this morning or this evening?
I'm great, Susan. It's a beautiful evening in England. And I was in a crop circle yesterday evening, which was absolutely wonderful. And I'm so looking forward to our conversation and that with our listeners.
Great. And I do want to let our listeners know that we are going to take questions. And for Jude, towards the end of the show, we'll see how far we can get because there is so much material to cover. What I wanted to do, Jude, I think, is the thing that kind of highlighted a lot of things for me in the book called Cosmos is the quotes that you all pulled from Albert Einstein. And, you know, maybe we can use that as a guide to kind of go through some of the concepts and theories that you go through. Because at the end of the day, I think what we're really saying is that there is a paradigm shift going on in the world, is there not?
I wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, as you know, Susan, I journey around the world. I take groups on sacred pilgrimages to some amazing sacred sites. I've just got back from Malta and before that Israel and Jordan. But I teach a very broad basis of work across the world, and everywhere I go, this shift is gathering pace. Very exciting time.
And, you know, in the book, and I'm kind of jumping ahead or jumping forward, and maybe we need to go backward a little bit, but that's okay, is that you say in the book that the shift really started back in the 60s. And for those of us who, you know, grew up as flower children and, you know, during the late 60s and, you know, the whole Haight-Ashbury movement, you know, that's really when this whole shift really started, wouldn't you say?
My sense is that it did. I mean, it's, sometimes when there is a tidal movement, it's difficult to sort of understand, you know, the first tiny waves that then become stronger and stronger. And I mean, you can sort of go back to the, you know, back to the Enlightenment, back through the 18th and 19th centuries. But I think really in our era, and it's really gathered pace since then, yeah, the 60s did it. And it's very interesting because earlier this year, in sort of late January, I got woken up at 4 a.m., as you do, and given some clairaudient guidance to look at the astrological influences at dawn on the 14th of February this year, and of course 14th of February, St. Valentine's Day, the day dedicated to love. And when I did, the most incredible astrology jumped out that reflected the song, the Dawning of the Age of Aquarius, from the musical Hair. And it was so powerful and so focused that I sent an email around to my list, and that ended up going around the world. And we actually figure out that something like 1 million people at least around the world on that dawn of this 14th of February really attuned their intention to the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, supported by the sort of planetary influences that really came together in an incredibly coherent way at that moment.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You might add me to the list. I didn't realize there was such a connection, but I was singing that song too, and I don't know if it was exactly that date, but it was sometime in February that the you know, that pretty much came to mind. Let's kind of jump back, I guess, to the scientific concept. And, I mean, the book starts off, and the first quote of Albert Einstein that you all use is, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." And maybe that could give you some insight on and how we can, you know, adjust to some of the scientific discoveries that have been going on for as many years, most recently, but also to you know, the discoveries that go back to very ancient times.
Well, absolutely. I think if Albert was with us today, he'd perhaps replace the word religion with spirituality.
Sure.
And you know, I think there was a very powerful point that he made, though, is that we've collectively, certainly in the West, we've followed for now several hundred years really a paradigm, a worldview that is scientific. The problem with that worldview is that it's a science that is very limited, and it erodes in that way for very good reason, because when the early scientists of the sort of the 17th century were wanting to explore the universe, what they came across was a very powerful church that deemed them heretical if they tried to look at, investigate anything that was not of the physical realm. So more and more their investigation was limited to the physical world. But part of that was that there was, a rift began between the world of physics, as it were, the physical world, and the world of spirit. And those two have been sort of apparently being separated further and further now for, as I say, 300 years or thereabouts. The thing is, science really is just a methodology, but the way it's being dealt with is that it's a methodology that's been applied to take things apart. And as Deepak Chopra once said, the problem with that approach is that, you know, it's like taking apart a radio and wondering where the music went to. It's a way of looking at the world, but it has its own strengths, but it has some very significant limitations. And what leading-edge science is now doing is realizing that we cannot understand the world unless we also, at the very heart of our understanding, position the understanding of consciousness. And that's where leading-edge science and frontier research into consciousness and ancient wisdom now are reconciling, coming together in an incredibly empowering new vision, which is the vision that Irvin and I write about in Cosmos.
And, you know, the next section says that you know, Albert Einstein says, God always takes the simplest way. And as hard as it was for me to understand some of the physics that you all, you know, go into, because again, my brain doesn't really function. I'm a musician. Now, what I did get, and I will tell you this is really funny, is as I was reading some of the physics, scientific stuff, and you started mentioning harmonic, you know, that resonated with me, using a term, because, you know, when you think of music, you know, you can play music in multiple keys and you still hear a song, and it comes together whether you play it in the key of C or you play it in the key of G. And you know, and after a while when I started, you know, making that comparison, so did you. So I thought to myself, you know, that as a non-scientist, as a you know, I guess what you'd put a right brain person, it began to make things make a lot more sense to me. So, you know, it's the whole spirituality of music. No matter where you go, it all, you know, focuses on. It's really simplistic. I mean, it really is simplistic, and
it's simple, but it's very profound. And again, you know, as we say in the book, and certainly my other writings and teachings, is that, yes, music is a cosmic language. What leading-edge science now is appreciating is that all that we call reality is integral on many, many different levels of experience and awareness, and is ultimately, as Einstein said, you know, about cosmic mind exploring itself. And the way it explores, the way that consciousness expresses itself in energy and matter and what we call the physical realm, is harmonic. Everything is part of an interrelated whole. And the way it interrelates is through resonance and coherence and attunement. You know, they're all words that you associate with music. And they're all words that are now being more and more associated with the nature of reality.
And it's very interesting, too, and, you know, the more I read the book, and, I mean, since I'm a genealogist, of course, you know, I started trying to put myself into, you know, the heads or the minds or the spirits or however you want to discuss it of some of my ancestors and, you know, trying to really look at how they were sensing and feeling and monitoring, you know, what was going on during the time periods that they live. And, you know, when you really get down to the end of the day, as I see it, and I mean, anybody can prove me wrong, is that, you know, although the technology, you know, has changed in the industrial age, the feelings, the sense, the birth beginning, the death, the end, the life journey, everybody experiences that in one way, shape, or form, no matter when they lived.
I agree. And I mean, I'm very fortunate to live in a beautiful landscape near Avesbury in England, which has been a sacred landscape for 6,000 years. And when I attune to the ancestors and go back to that sort of era, and I work also with indigenous elders around the world, that have still got this worldview, it seems to be a worldview that recognizes that we are all one, that we're all interconnected and part of a web of life, that we are connected beyond the sort of limitations of space and time. And what their intuitive wisdom understood, we're now, if you like, finding another language, the language of science, to explain. But, you know, you go back 2,500 years, and far longer than that, but say 2,500 years, and Buddha described the world in a very, very similar way to that which we're now expressing and calling the holographic universe.
And I remember reading that in the book. And, you know, one of the things that I enjoyed, too, and, I mean, I really got into the Einstein quotes that you used to get through the book. But, you know, this one really goes to that whole thing, you know, subject of time and space. And he says, when you're courting a nice girl, an hour seems like a second. When you sit on a red-hot cinder, A second seems like an hour. That's relativity.
I love it too.
And it's true. Yeah. You know, the happier you are and the more blissful your life is, the more time flies. And they always say, you know, time flies when you're having fun. And,
yeah,
you know, when things are not going so well in your life, you know, it just seems to go on and on and on and on forever. And I just enjoyed that whole thing about his description of relativity. I mean, that was in terms that I could understand.
Well, he was a great communicator, a lovely man. And I really felt his presence with me the whole time that, you know, I was working on the book. And it felt very right to have those quotes. I think the other thing as well is that not only does time seem to shoot by, but don't you find as well that we're in the present. We truly are present when we're joyful, when we're loving, when we're really happy. Then we are in the present. But the less happy we are, the more sort of, instead of loving, we're perhaps more fearful or whatever those other emotions are. The more we tend to live either in the future or in the past or in the present.
Right.
And the happier we are, the more alive we are, the more attuned we are to the flow of the cosmos, the more we're fully present.
And it is a flow. It's a wave. I mean, you know, and I think as we get through some of the concepts that you have, you know, I think one of the things that really, you know, having grown up with the World Wide Web and having been involved in one of the first social networks on the internet back in you know, the late 80s, early 90s, you know, when I think one of the scientists, and again, my scientific side of me is not working, is that when he said he went and measured what he thought to be the amount of energy on the on the World Wide Web, that it was measured as a grain of salt. And I found that to be...
I wrote about that because that really struck me as well. Really struck me. But I think that the thing that you know, is really coming out so strongly now, and this is why, you know, the emerging vision of integral reality is that literally everything is consciousness, is that when the guys that were studying computers and the ability to hold data and information within computers were looking at it mathematically, because you, like me, prefer the language of music, but there is a language of mathematics that's also a cosmic language, in my view. And when they were looking at the maximum amount of information that could be held within a computer or squirted down a telephone line, they found that maximum information was exactly the same mathematics that described the maximum amount of energy able to be held within space. So what this is leading to now, which I think is absolutely crucial, is an understanding that information, and so consciousness ultimately, is more fundamental than space and time and matter and energy. And when you really start to get that understanding, then that's a whole new way of seeing the world, and that's really the world, the emerging vision of integral reality and the whole world that we write about in the book.
And that really kind of leads to the quote that you used here too. It says, there's no logical way to the discovery of these elemental laws. There is only the way of intuition, which is helped by a feeling for the order lying behind the appearance.
Yeah.
I mean, this man was pretty incredible. And I heard that he really, I think I read somewhere that his whole findings on his whole theory of relativity, he says, was done through intuition. And, you know, I think that a lot of what we as individuals, you know, come up with creatively comes to us intuitively. It doesn't come to us because we sit there and mathematically try to figure out how we're going to do something.
I agree. I mean, the math falls out afterwards. But, you know, he started to sort of understand the relative nature of space and time when he was 16 years old. And you did that by intuitively following a beam of light. And it took him years to understand what that beam would and wouldn't do and how it would behave. And it behaved in a way completely differently to what everybody else at the time thought. He then proved it mathematically. But essentially, he realized that the faster you go, time literally slows down. But that was an intuitive journey that he undertook. The other person, I mean, another famous example of what you're saying is the discovery of DNA.
Right.
Because that came, I can't remember whether it's Crick or Watson, but one of them has acknowledged that the whole helical structure of DNA came in a dream.
And, you know, in genealogy, I mean, I did a whole show on DNA a couple of weeks ago with a friend of mine who I worked with back in, 2000, I think it was, when he came up with the idea of using DNA as a way to break down barriers when the paper trail ended for a lot of people in their research. And it's been an amazing growth in both his company and similar companies throughout the world and in the field of genealogy. Because it really has some far-reaching implications, for people like myself whose mother was adopted, and I mean, my paper trail ends with my mother for all practical purposes.
Yeah. Well, mine doesn't even, I mean, my mother's line goes, for me, my trail genealogically only goes back two generations on my mother's side, and I never knew my biological father. So for me, it's been really interesting because all my life I've been, walking between worlds as a sensitive and as well as a scientist, a mystic as well as a scientist. So my connections with the ancestors have been actually not on a personal level, but they've been on, if you like, a collective level. So I've worked as a sort of on a clairaudient basis and psychic basis with many iconic ancestors to understand, some of our hidden history. And more what I've been finding, and this has been very true in the last couple of years, how powerfully the ancestors are coming forward. And almost it's though we're not going back to them, they're coming forward at this time. It seems to me to be very powerful voices and support for the shift of consciousness.
Wow, I didn't even think about that. But I mean, those that are doing a lot of the mediumship work, I listen to them all the time, and some of the Lisa Williams and Colette Baron Reeds and John Hollins and you name it, and Sylvia Browns. I mean, they seem to be getting information fast and furious, and I guess it may be more part of the times as well as their ability to tune in that may not have existed as loudly, I guess, if you want to speak to it in that terms, as it would have been 40, 50, 60 years ago.
I feel that's the case. I mean, there've always been incredibly gifted psychics and mediums, but I think this whole shift of consciousness, which is a collective shift, our vibration is increasing. We are expanding beyond the limitations of our personas. And I think the veils are getting thinner. And therefore, more and more people are being able to really make that very strong connection with both their higher selves and the voices. Many more people are connecting with angelic beings, devic beings, extraterrestrial influences, and the ancestors. And certainly, for me, my mum used to say, I'll talk with anyone. And so I talk with all of these discarnate folks and have them since I was 4 years old. And I talk to the odd, living person as well. But I do think those voices are coming forward more strongly and in such a beautiful way.
So the next chapter in this book kind of leads us right where we've been. And it says, all religions, arts and sciences are branches of the same tree. Mm-hmm. And really, truly, going back to the beginning of time, so are all of we.
Indeed.
Just branches of the same tree.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're talking about DNA and genealogy. I mean, obviously, you'll be aware, I'm sure many of our listeners are, that when the Human Genome Project was completed a few years ago, what it showed was really against all anticipation or expectation, because what it showed is just how common our DNA is. I know we have differences, but that within our entire human global family of, what, 6.7 billion people now, we actually have less genetic diversity than a family of chimpanzees living on a mountain somewhere in Central Africa. We are, you know, the commonality between us, the unity that underlies our diversity, is far more significant than the perceived differences that we have between ourselves.
Yeah, it is amazing. And I mean, you know, my family's had our DNA tested too, and we're in the pool, so to speak. And you know, we do belong to one specific haplogroup that, you know, I'm really tracing to see if I can connect my mother's, you know, my mother's family. And interestingly enough, we do connect DNA wise to a lot of people on my mother's side, because we had my brother's mtDNA done, but nobody seems to want to claim ownership to you know, a woman who had a child out of wedlock in 1929. So I'm trying to find that person, but it's been quite an interesting journey, to say the least. Now, we get into
every good wish on following that back and really reclaiming that sort of aspect of yourself.
And, you know, I really want to, and I think that I've kind of come to the conclusion that between this DNA and between, I guess, the whole concept of this paradigm shift, and the fact that I too have become part of the opening up of my intuitive self, and, you know, beginning to see things and hear things and feel things that I don't think I've ever allowed myself to feel over these, you know, prior to this time. That, you know, between the two of these things, I think it may happen. And, you know, I had, I don't know if you're familiar with Rita Berkowitz, who's a spiritual medium in the Boston area. And she calls herself the spirit artist, because not only is she a medium, but she can actually draw images of the people, you know, the spirits that she sees. And I did both a show with her and an article about it in my column in the Examiner, and the images and the pictures of, you know, the real thing and the images that she drew were absolutely astounding. So
absolutely, and I'm not surprised. I mean, there are a number of people working in that way, well, certainly around the world. Interestingly enough, I'm not an artist, but when I've worked with people, many, many people in the past, and worked with either regression with them or actually, you know, connected with their ancestors, what I often find is that an ancestor will come forward and the face, and will overlight, if you like, the face of the person I'm working with, such that I can describe the features of the ancestor to them. And I can say, you know, it's so-and-so, and he's this age, and he looks like this, and da-da-da. And although I haven't been able to draw it, the view is so clear that person's been able to identify, you know, which sort of ancestor it is.
You know, it really is interesting. And, I mean, you know, in some of the cases that I have with myself, I can see an image. I mean, I can see almost every feature of somebody. I have no idea. I haven't gotten to the point where I know who they are. But
well,
I mean,
you can see them. You can
see them.
You can have a really clear sense of them.
Absolutely. And you know, I've always been able to do this. I just never knew what it was, and I never knew what I was doing. And so, you know, I mean, it's always been these fleeting images.
Can I interrupt you? I've got a horrible feeling we're going to lose the line in a moment. Because you're in the US and I'm in the UK, yeah? May I ask you if we do lose the line, because I don't want to lose our discussion with our listeners, could you call me back on the same code but a different number?
Yeah, why don't you give me the number?
Okay, +44 for the UK, 1793-739191.
Yeah.
Let's keep talking, but just in case, because technology sometimes has a way of confounding us.
Okay. Moving on to some of Einstein's comments. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison, the illusion of space and time, by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. I mean, he was right on.
Oh, he was so right on. And you know what I love about Albert is that he wasn't just a great pioneering scientist, but he was a great humanitarian. And for much of his later years, he strove, you know, without stopping for peace. He was a great peacemaker. He was a great supporter of peace initiatives around the world. You know, I think that ultimately is as powerful a contribution as the science he brought forward.
And I think, too, that's really the direction everybody is trying really to move forward. You know, I've put on my website that I am just, I want so, so much to try to bring younger generations into the field of genealogy. Not so much to be in the field of genealogy, but because I really believe that by learning about their past and then being able to compare their past with pasts of people from other cultures and other countries, and to see that everybody really is on the same plane, that I can't see a better modality to bridge understanding and possibly build tolerance than you know, learning through personal experience about one's history. That's my feeling.
I think it's very, very important. And someone once said, you know, unless we understand our past, we're sort of destined to continue its mistakes. And in a way, you know, the more we do understand, I also believe that there's a huge amount of what I describe as our hidden history, our hidden heritage, that's actually starting to sort of come forward. You know, when we were, both of us were at school, you know, the version of history that was given, I think, was incredibly limited and in some cases, you know, downright untruthful. And I think that one of the aspects of the shift, which I think is very important, is that so much more of our hidden heritage is coming to light. And as it does so, I think then we can together heal the schisms that have separated and find ways of reconciling and ways of forgiving and ways, therefore, of coming together in peace, in resolution. And I think that's a wonderfully exciting and joyous aspect of this shift for me.
You know, that's something that I look very much forward to. You know, I've always, ever since I can, when I was a very young kid, when we were going through the Cuban crisis, I had terrible, terrible nightmares about, you know, being separated from my family. And you know, we were running these drills because I lived in New Orleans, that, you know, if we were bombed, you know, that the school would take us and separately from our parents. And it was, you know, it was a devastating, I mean, it just devastated me, you know, which probably is why I have had so much empathy for, you know, the people who have done their, you know, their Holocaust research and the lives and the separation. And I mean, that in that direction, I can definitely call myself an empath. I can definitely feel that separation that those families had during that period of time. It just it just breaks my heart. I mean, but I had, terrible issues with that growing up. I've probably never mentioned publicly anyway. Beyond the brain, you say.
I can sympathize with that because I was, a while ago, I was asked to speak in Amsterdam about my work. And we've had a couple of times, and my husband and I were able to go to the Anne Frank Museum and the Anne Frank house where she, for 2 years, with her family, had hidden before they were taken away. And we had the incredible good fortune to be able to be in her room, just the two of us, with her spirit, with her being, for some time, because usually it's very, very busy there. There's so many people now want to know her story and empathize with her. But it was just very special just to really feel how this 14-year-old girl, on the verge of growing up, had such an unbelievably difficult time, as did so many, many, many people. But she, one of the things that she wrote was that in her diary was how throughout it all she still held on to the belief that people are intrinsically good. But at their deepest level, they are good.
Yeah, she was so wise beyond her years. Yeah. And that's proven in her work, in that diary. I mean, it was just I've been there myself several times, and I've actually been to many of the concentration camps, Auschwitz, several times, and I don't know, it's very, very, very potent as far as energy feels there.
It is incredibly, incredibly potent and desolate. And I work around the world, working energetically to help heal people and places of these rifts, these traumas in the field of consciousness. But what I find is that I've been to Israel and recently come back from a trip with a group of people to Israel and Jordan. And what I find there and what I find around the world is that where there are schisms, you do get situations where, and this happens in our own behavior patterns as well. I think when people have been on the receiving end of great, great trauma, there can be, they can also be the ones that perpetrate the pain on others. And I'm not trying to equate the Holocaust with anything. I don't think there's anything comparable. But being in the Palestinian territories and seeing how difficult life is there, it seems to me that nobody is having a healthy life there, a life of well-being there. And there's got to come a point where somehow, some way, the whole Palestinian-Israeli situation can be reconciled. And I think it has to be done with authenticity and truth and openness and a willingness to reach out. And it's very, very difficult. And I've spent many years now trying to understand on an energetic level what's played out there, going back to the time of Abraham and before that even. And it feels to me that we do have an opportunity as part of this shift of awareness to heal the situation there. But it's one that still feels, there's got to be a huge opening of the heart to enable that to happen.
I agree. I've been to Israel too myself once, and it's a very, very difficult situation, and on both sides of the fence. And as with you, I feel for all of them. I would love to see peace not only there but throughout the whole world. Mm-hmm. What wonderful things we could do if we could shift our energies into positive things rather than into negative, hurtful things. We could build quite a life for our descendants, could we not?
Absolutely. I mean, and for me, this is an incredible moment in our history. I mean, as we write about in Cosmos and as I write about in my other books, you know, as this shift gathers pace, we with the mindset we've had, with the world that we've had of the mainstream and reductionist science, you know, the word mainstream science has seen the world as meaningless, as random, as fragmented. But what's emerging, this new vision, is empowering and inspiring, and it's showing us that the world, that the cosmos really is a whole world, and that we're innately interconnected beyond space and time, and that we truly are all one. We are microcosms, as the ancients understood, of cosmic mind exploring itself. And the leading-edge scientific evidence for this, and the consciousness research and the evidence from there for this, is getting so powerful, almost overwhelming, that this whole new paradigm, I think, really is on the verge of going really into our collective psyche. And that, for me, is crucial, because as long as many people do see the world in the old way, the old paradigm, then that has brought us, as I think we'd all agree, to the edge of a potential global breakdown. But we have the opportunity, as you've been saying, as we really re-envisage the world and who we really are, to transform that potential breakdown into a collective breakthrough. And I think that is what all of us who are working around the world for this, that is our dream, that is our vision, and that more and more and more people around the world are also seeing it, experiencing it for themselves. And that's how the shift is gathering pace. It's not coming top down. It's actually emerging bottom up, you know, at the grassroots level, by every person having their own experiences and their own breakthrough and their own expansion and understanding, as you were saying you've been having.
Right, and I think you mentioned in your book that and referring it to something a little differently, but I think it makes sense here. It's growing organically rather than organizationally.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, organisms and organizations can actually operate and embody the same principles. It's just that the organizations, the corporate organizations and institutions in to date have been based on that sort of what I think is the outworn paradigm, that limited paradigm of reductionist science. And I think as the shift accelerates, you know, people, entrepreneurs, politicians, every walk of life are beginning to re-envisage the world, and therefore new ways of organizing ourselves that are far more co-creative are emerging. They're already emerging.
It's really exciting. Let's do this. I'm going to give out some numbers. Let's see if we have some listeners that want to call in and ask some questions, and or see if they have any questions of you, Jude. The call-in number is 1-888-815-9756, and that is a worldwide number. And hopefully there are a number of numbers underneath that so it's not just one number, but they will roll over. So in any event, we will continue to talk, and if anybody does have some questions, we really would love to hear from you. Because I really think that what we are dealing with here is probably one of the most important things that we can all be involved in this lifetime. I really do. And you know, here we go into more of Einstein. When the solution is simple, God is answering. Interesting, huh?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the research and the experiences that I've had over the last 53 years, because I started when I was 4 years old, have, you know, backed his perspective time and time and time again. It's when we make things complicated that my sense is we move out of the flow of the cosmos. And that the, you know, the diversity, the incredible abundance and diversity of the physical world, when you actually look at the fractal patterns that underlie it, those fractal patterns are incredibly, exquisitely simple. Yet out of them emerges all the diversity that we experience every day.
Einstein again. I mean, this is what you guys have done is just incredible, in my opinion. No problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it.
And that is the point of the shift, because if we were still going on, and making the same choices that we've been making for however long, this potentiality of a breakdown, I think, would occur, because, you know, we're driving the car in that direction, and unless we change direction, we're heading over the cliff. But the point of the shift, and as a healer and as a sensitive, you know, I've worked with this for a very long time around the world. But the whole essence of the shift is that we are both individually and collectively expanding our awareness. So we're literally beginning to see the world, the cosmos, ourselves, and to experience it in this whole new way. And there's an old saying that, you know, seeing is believing, but what experiments show is that actually believing is seeing. What we can't believe, what we can't imagine, we don't see. We can't manifest. But now as our understanding is expanding, as our awareness is growing, we're beginning to believe and imagine and dream and see the possibilities in a different way as part of a whole world where we're not just the creation of the cosmos, but we're very much the co-creators on all different levels of awareness, but ultimately the co-creators of our realities.
You know, and When we get into this whole thing, I mean, you know, and Einstein says it here when you quote him, where true religion is real living, living with all one's soul, with all one's goodness and righteousness. And, you know, that really is, and I believe, and where was I going? My last article on The Examiner, I spoke about this. It was on forgiveness, but there isn't a religion, organized religion in this world that does not have a prayer for forgiveness.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it is surely that we have to live it, because Barack Obama gave, I don't know if our listeners or you heard it, but I heard the whole of his recent speech to the Muslim world. And at the end of that speech, he said something that was, again, very simple and very profound. What he essentially said is every religious tradition, in some form or another, embodies the golden rule. In other words, treat others as you would hope they would treat you. And the point is that one of the simplest and yet most profound teachings in all the world's traditions. The difference, or the point that he was trying to make as well, is that the teaching is there, but we have to live that, we have to embody that, because we have to walk the talk. We have to walk the talk, we have to live this. As Gandhi also said, be the change you want to see in the world. And if we're not prepared to be that change, if we're just judging others and you know, projecting our own judgments on them, but yet not willing to live that golden rule in our own lives, then nothing changes. And if we do live the golden rule in our own lives, I believe that the whole world will change in the blink of an eye.
And you closed this book with, I thought, four very profound statements. And the first one was, the enemy is one's own self.
Yes.
Hatred injures the one hating more than the one hated.
Yeah.
Forgiveness is possible without forgetting, colluding with, or denying what has gone before. And I think that's where most people get hung up on forgiveness, and I think that that's been a big one for me too, is, You know, how you say, how can you forgive somebody for doing this? And you the forgiveness is not, you don't forget.
No.
You know, and you don't deny that something happened.
Exactly.
And that's probably the hardest thing, I think, that most people have problems with.
I totally wholeheartedly understand that. And on a very personal level, I undertook some very profound forgiveness a couple of days ago. 10 years ago, my now ex-husband, but then husband, fell in love with someone else. And that woman effectively took him from me. And now I'm happily remarried, but there was still the hurt within me. I hadn't seen her for 10 years, and I was giving a talk at a conference on Sunday, and out of the blue, she arrived. And the first thing I knew was that she was there holding my hand. And she said, "I'm not going to say I'm sorry." And I knew in that moment that I didn't need her to say sorry, and that I forgave her.
Wow.
And it wasn't the words, it was the feeling. I don't think, you know, people say you're forgiving, but, you know, it's how you feel. But you know when you have. And in that moment, all that residual pain that at some subconscious level was still with me was released.
And I can't imagine, you know, how that feels. I mean, that must be probably one of the most blissful feelings ever.
It is, because although I'd worked very hard to move on, and I'm very happily remarried, the pain of that time, whatever was still left within me, I'd suppressed and subdued. But very interestingly, I started to feel that pain a couple of days before the conference, and I didn't know why. And then when I saw her, or she saw me, I knew that it was time to release it. And if it had been hurting me at some level, part of me was still dismembered, and I needed to remember myself. And in that moment of forgiveness, all that hurt released, and I was able to remember myself.
Wow. Well, I know from my personal experience, I have a few of those situations, but I haven't quite gotten there yet. I'm working at it. I really am working at it. And I speak to it a lot, but I don't think that I've totally gotten over, you know, being able to get it down to that level. I really try to talk myself into it every day sometimes. I really do.
Well, you know, we're all of us on the same journey, and we're all of us still fellow.
Right, and we're all still learning. I mean, you know, some of us... at a faster pace than others, and some of us slower, and some of us sometimes never get there. One of the things that I was also, and you know, we have a few minutes left, about 5 or 6 to be exact. There are a couple of other profound things that I found in this book that we haven't addressed. And I'm going to do what I always do, is forget what I was going to say. I think it happens once in every show.
Well, I call it a senior moment, and I have them all the time.
You wrote this book when? This book, and that's what's going to lead me into... These comments. The book was written, 2007?
Yeah, it was published last year, last August, by Hay House in the US and the UK, and it's the books now are moving. My books generally are in about 13 languages now, in about 27 countries, something like that.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the things that I think that you mentioned as part of the shift, and I think you attributed it to somebody who wrote a book called Affluenza.
Yeah,
I laughed. And not influenza, affluenza. And basically,
affluenza.
Yes. And, I mean, the way you basically described that was that, you know, this whole economic crisis that we're living in is really part of the shift.
I feel it really is. I was guided by my, you know, by spirit a year before it happened that it was going to happen and that it was crucial because the, you know, our economies and the way we measure economic activity is basically, you know, based on two things, consumerism and conflict. And, you know, that is totally unsustainable in terms of the fragmentation of our societies, in terms of the injustices, in terms of the unsustainability of its use of resources and the earth, the living earth's resources. So very much, you know, to move from one paradigm to another really requires the old to fall away so that we can together, you know, co-create something more sustainable, something more in harmony with the flow of the cosmos. I think that's what's happening. But we have to continue that process. It's no good as sort of thinking it's just a downside and going back to the old ways. I think we have a window of opportunity to really completely reset the way we measure economic well-being. And the Kingdom of Bhutan has spent many years moving from, you know, gross domestic product to gross domestic happiness, which includes economics, but it also includes culture and health and other measures of well-being.
Now, what country is this? I kind of like that, that thought.
It's Bhutan, Bhutan, and it's a small country up in the Himalayas near Nepal. But the point is that it's done a huge amount of work to really ground the measures of gross domestic happiness. You know, it's not airy-fairy. It sort of looks at economics. It looks at these other aspects, and it's found quantifiable ways of defining them, but also a way of evolving them over time on the basis of everyone's input. So I think it's an incredibly positive way that in this window of opportunity, we could really take some big steps to getting a much more healthy way of looking how we organize and how we, you know, how we base our society.
I really like that concept. Really like that concept. Jude, yeah, before we close, you want to let everybody know how they can find you?
Oh, thank you, Susan. Basically, my website, again, very simple, is www.judecurivan.com, and you spell my name JudeCurivan, and people can email me, jude@judecurivan.com, and details of my forthcoming events and journeys and books and all the other stuff I'm involved with.
And you also have a mailing list that people can subscribe to as well, don't you, that you know, keeps them up to date on all the things that you're doing. I know
do.
I am
and
subscribed.
They can go to Hay House, or they can go to my website and they can sign up for my free newsletter, which goes out about 4 times a year.
Wonderful. This has been very pleasant, very exciting. I've enjoyed every minute of it. This book was just really a fascinating read. As I said, I've read it several times, and every time I read it, a different thing kind of popped out at me that, you know, I just felt very compelling, and you know, and especially for those of us who really do feel that there is a shift going on, and that things are different and need to be way different. And, you know, I think that those of us who, I guess the baby boomers, I think you and I are about the same age, from the additions that you made earlier in the show, so I guess I'm making my pronouncement too, you know, and I think that maybe the baby boomer generation, since we were the ones that got into the whole love and compassion thing in the 60s, you know, are ready to try to get this thing finalized once and for all. And, you know, we don't have a lot of the prior generations holding us back. Maybe that's what's really going on. What do you think?
I agree, but I feel that this shift is almost wave after, you know, when it's like when a tide changes, you know, the first waves go up on the beach and then more waves come and more waves come. And I think you're absolutely right. I think our generation, the baby boomers, you know, have a huge opportunity and responsibility to really move this shift forward. But the guys that are coming in the next generations, they're the ones that I think are really going to embody it. And the kids that are being born now are amazing because so many of them haven't forgotten, you know, that they are spiritual beings having a human experience. And I think they are the ones that will really take us through into what I truly believe can be a new golden age and the next, you know, the next evolutionary leap in our collective journey as human beings.
So, you know, if we believe in this, then, you know, there's beauty and light at the end of this tunnel.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we've experienced over the last, 20, 25 years could very well be a thing of the past. Jude, I thank you for your time. I know it's getting late over there in the UK. I'm glad I didn't have you up in the middle of the night as we originally had scheduled. But I've really enjoyed it. And I'm Susan King. This is where genealogy and spirit connect. As you can see, it connects every which way from Sunday, in my opinion, or every which way Tuesday. And my website is www.susaneking.com. And I welcome you to join me there anytime that you like. And we'll see you next Tuesday. Our guest next week is going to be very interesting because we kind of mentioned it today, and that is Genealogy for Kids. Ira Wolfman is going to be my guest. Again, till next week, this is Susan King. We'll see you then.